options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
Hey everybody, I'm David Pegler. Just introducing you to a new series of ours that we're offering on options. You'll know me from Tier 1 Alpha and bickering with Craig Peterson and Mark Green on Monday regularly. I'm joined today by Troy Cates and Garrett Paulella. And you guys want to introduce yourselves from Neos Investments. And one of my favorite investors and thinkers in the world is Professor Scott Galloway from NYU. And he always says that to be good at anything, don't follow your passion. Follow one thing that you can be good at for years and years and years. And anybody who says follow your passion is already a billionaire. So you guys have done that. You've dedicated your lives to options, really, or professionally. So I'll let you introduce yourselves.
Sure. Garrett Paulella, co-founder, managing partner of Neos Investments. Troy and I have actually worked together for almost 15, 20 years, since 2008. And we've really dedicated our careers to option-based strategies, starting on the institutional side, where we worked at a trading and research firm. And then we've really been pioneering the option-based ETF category. So options are a passion, mine personally. Trade a lot of it in my portfolio as well as within our funds.
How about you, Troy?
Yeah, Troy Cates, co-founding managing partner at Neos Investments. And like Garrett said, I've been working with him for over 15 years. So we've been working together a long time, focusing on option-based products, option-based ETFs. And prior to that, I spent a good 10 years. So I've been in the business for over 25 years now. Spent a good 10 years more on the trading side of the business with market making and trading and execution. So our focus is really around option-based ETFs, yeah, and options in general.
So what brought you guys together in particular, do you think? Meaning that what strengths did each one of you bring in the options field that really made the marriage pleasant?
I think when Garrett started at the firm where we both met over 15 years ago, he was new coming into the business. I had already had 10 years in the business where I'd been trading equities, options, and he really wanted to dive in and sit with us on the trading desk and really understand it. And he showed this like really initial passion for that part of the business. And since then, we just hit it off right away. We worked together for a number of years. We ran a number of businesses together. We sold a business together. And we still are now growing another business together, yeah, in Neos. So I think, as far as two co-founders, there's, he focuses a lot on the business development and more on that side of the business. I focus a lot on the portfolio management. But together, there's no light between us. We run the business, yeah, together.
Yeah. Full honesty of what he had said is I was interested and Troy was willing to take me under his wing, yeah, and teach me the initial basics, so I didn't sound foolish on the rest of the desk with everybody who would have obviously given some grief for that. So he helped bring me up in the business. We had this great opportunity to help grow that company, build out their option trading platform. Yeah. It was really focused around equities at that time. And we saw that both of us had a deep desire in the option-based space. We worked really well together. We also, had a great friendship and continue to, today. And that's honestly been really the crux of our partnership. The two of us work really well together. We support each other. When one needs something, the other one helps support. But we do bring, I think, two strengths also that are very complementary to one another.
So one of the some of the things we do at Tier 1, obviously, is use the option market, use volatility to then figure out what's going on in the systematic world, where you guys are more practitioners on the option side. So this is actually an exciting opportunity for me as well. So what I figured would be one of the goals for us would be to demystify options a little bit. One of the barriers to entry for a lot of folks is simply the terminology. Options carry their own vocabulary, which is second nature to people in the options market. But to those on the outside, they have no idea or very little idea. It's something that's talked about more and more and more, but I feel like there's a vacuum of information. So maybe we can go through some terminology and then we can dig into how you guys are using your strategies to build these options overlaid ETFs and then kind of get a practitioner's background to that, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, that's good.
Options have exploded. If you want to, Eric, if you want to bring up our first slide on just, you know, options volumes in the last few years, what do you attribute this to, and why do you think options have become so popular? Do you think it's the Robin Hood effect of gamifying options that's helped, or just an awareness of the space? How do you feel about that?
I think that's definitely part of it, but I think there's also more education out there. You know, 10 years ago, you couldn't find this education online, where now there's outlets like this one and others where you can get really informed about options in general. And then, yes, the COVID effect and everything with the, you know, gamification of options. But I think as people started to dive in and really look at how options can help their portfolios, whether that's the hedge part of the portfolio, whether that's to bring in additional income, I think it's only gained awareness and people have grown from there.
Yeah. Do you think the Robinhood effect was overall a net positive for the space?
I think so, because it just gave awareness, as both of you just mentioned. And it as we talked about demystifying, right, it brought this options and this connotation, right, of using options as risky, as leverage, into actually, you know, bringing it down to a much more level playing field where everyone realized you could use it just actually as a hedge part of your portfolio. You could do it to reduce volatility and risk. You could use options to create income. You know, and I think now that people understand that there's multiple ways to utilize options as a piece of your portfolio, it's definitely gained in popularity. You also started to see more comfort level of investors using options-oriented funds. And I think that was another piece of the market that I think if we look at Morningstar, like about 10 years ago, there was probably about 25, 30 maybe total funds out there across mutual funds, ETFs, anything in that commingled space that used options. You look at that today and I think it's over 400, right? So there's been a big growth in the ability to be able to invest directly in option-based funds, which has helped people get comfortable with what option-based strategies could do if they're not comfortable trading them directly. So I think coupled with shows like Tier 1 Alpha, you know, and what Hedgeye is doing to be able to explain, you know, option-based strategies, other types of research for direct investors, you know, that helps support the growth of the overall market.
Do you find that a lot of your clients like to know how the sausage is made, or they just like to see the end product?
I think a lot want to understand. I think initially they want to see the end product. They want to see total return. They want to see what kind of income we're generating using options in an ETF. But then once we get them on a call, they want to understand it so they could explain it to their clients. If we're talking to an advisor who really wants to understand how this specific, you know, covered call product works, or how we're selling put spreads, what does that mean? Why is it bringing in income? What is my risk? I think they really need to understand it so they feel comfortable talking to their clients about it.
Yeah. Should we dig in a little bit on some terminology and then we can kind of back that into strategies?
Sure. That'd be great.
So what is an option in purely layman's terms? What is an option? What are the conditions of it? Can you describe, you know, what it is to be long an option, what it is to be short an option? And I made up a little cheat sheet here slide two. There we go. And we can get into a little bit of the Greeks. But what is a long call? What is it to be short a call? What is it to be long a put? What is it to be short a put?
Yeah, I would say option contract in general, it's a contract between two parties. Somebody owns an asset, whether that be an equity or an index like the S&P 500, and someone doesn't, but they would like exposure to that. So at one point, the person who owns the asset is allowed to sell you a certain percentage of what their exposure could be. So if we're talking about a covered call in particular, someone might own 100 shares of Apple, and it might be worth about $180 a share right now. Someone might want to buy a long call. And so if they want to buy a long call, they choose a level that they want to have exposure to Apple. Let's say that's $200. Well, that individual that owns the 100 shares could sell a call option to the buyer of a call option so that they appreciate and get all the performance of Apple from 200 up to, you know, an unlimited amount. The seller of that call option only participates up to $200. So it's a contract between two parties for a specified price of the underlying investment for a specified time period. And it allows the two to be able to gain the exposure that they want. So the buyer of a call option pays for it. The seller receives, you know, that price. So the hope for the seller is the price stays at or below that level. And for the buyer, they want that price of the reference asset to go above it, and then they would profit.
So a lot of the questions that I get at barbecues, and whenever I'm asked about options, or rather people ask me what I do, and I say in an options derivative business, I get that glazed over look on their face. But what a lot of people say to me is, well, even if I'm right, I tend to lose money sometimes. So there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of moving parts to options. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the anatomy of options pricing in terms of, you know, what makes up an options premium. If I'm buying a call, for instance, what is intrinsic value, what is extrinsic value, and can you shed some light on those two terms?
Sure. So when you're thinking about it, going back to that Apple example that Garrett was talking about, if you have a stock that's worth, you know, $180 stock, but you're buying this, you know, $200 call, the intrinsic value is the difference between the actual price of the underlying reference asset and the strike price of the option. The time value is how far out till that actual contract expires. So is it 1 week, 1 month, 6 months? That is with the time value. And the further out that time value, you'll have more premium because you'll be paying more to have that time for that, hopefully, that reference asset to go above that strike price.
So in simplistic terms, you know, intrinsic value is really in the money, and extrinsic value is essentially time and the implied volatility of the contract. Is that
yes.
fair to say? should we talk a little bit about the Greeks? Why are they measured in Greeks in the first place? Why don't we use normal words? Why do we use Greeks for these?
It's complicated for people, right? I mean, they should just make it much more simple, you know, than that. But they have chose really not to. I think when you really want to think about the Greeks, they do try to keep them simple between, you know, delta, theta, you know, gamma, and vega. And what are those four ultimately meaning for, you know, the volatility, you know, from a vega standpoint of the underlying actual reference asset, right, that options contract. You know, delta, what's like the actual move going to be, you know, within, you know, that reference asset? Like, how much does it move? Is it up 1%, you know, the price of Apple on a daily basis? Like, how is that going to drive your participation, your contract price for what the underlying, you know, reference asset is? You know, obviously gamma, thinking about, you know, just the overall, you know, risk in the option contract, kind of mixing everything together. So although they don't make things as simple with layman's terms, you know, each one does have a direct meaning that's helping ultimately drive the price of the option contract.
So let's talk a little bit about delta, because delta is, you know, theoretically how much the underlying has to move to theoretically change the price of the option. So can you give some examples of what a option or a long call with a 0.3 delta would be as opposed to one with 0.5? Why are they different?
Yeah, so if you're looking at, to give you a good example, you go back to that Apple example with $180 reference price, a 50 delta or a 0.5 delta on a short call would mean that going out probably about a month in duration, you'd be looking at the money, meaning that that strike price is at or around $180. If you're looking further out, the deltas will go lower for that short call. So if you're looking at a 30 delta, you might be 1, 2% out of the money compared to where the reference asset price is. And it's really just to break it down. It's giving you, if you think about it as a 30 delta, you're saying that there's probably a probability of a 30% probability of that strike finishing in the money when it expires. So that's kind of how it's a good gauge to think about it.
And how are those probabilities calculated? Or how do we think about those probabilities?
So the probabilities are calculated by one, intrinsic value, and looking at a number of different things. So as Garrett had mentioned before, going through gamma, vega, and theta. Theta is really the time decay.
Sure.
That's an important one, as we talked earlier, between intrinsic value and time decay. There's a number of calculations you could do to figure these out, but a lot of people will just pull up their screens, whether it's a Bloomberg or some other terminal they're looking at, and really just see where those actual deltas are being calculated when they're using those different reference assets.
So let's bring it back to theta just for a minute. So time decay. Can you explain to people how theta is not a linear fall off? I mean, as we get closer to expiration, theta drops off precipitously. How can we think through that? Why is that the case?
Well, the probability of the exercise of that option contract comes much more rapidly, right? So as that time is decaying, you still have more time in the beginning part of that contract to know whether it's the unknown, that whether that reference asset is going to reach that potential level where the contract would either be in the money for the buyer, or out of the money. As we start to get closer and the probability of those days or that time is much less, then it's going to quickly evaporate the theta off of it, the time value that's left in that, because there's just less of a risk. There's less of a probability that that contract is going to go one way or the other. And so really, even as we think about our entire business and our products and the way we manage money, for us, everything is probabilities, right? So
right.
We're understanding the underlying probability of the options and all the Greeks that we just spoke about. But what's the probability of our entire investment strategy delivering its investment objective? So I think as we think about theta, as we get much closer, there's a quick, decline because there's less of a probability that that option contract, will pay off for whichever party it's going to end up, landing on.
Have you developed rules kind of particularly as an exit strategy for your positions around theta?
Sure. I mean, a number of our products, they're all rules-based. They're all systematic in nature. And as Garrett was saying, when we're building a product, we're looking at building what is the probability analysis of that product performing how we're hoping it performs. And a lot of that comes into our active management of the options. So some of the products we have, we do have, exit strategies where we might close a short call or a long put or a short put prior to the expiration if it does certain things within that time period.
Now, one of the things that we concentrate on is obviously gamma and what that means from a dealer hedging standpoint. Can you describe what gamma is, just in terms of it representing a rate of change of delta, basically, is how I like to think through it. It's, essentially the slope of a delta curve and the steepness of it in complete layman's terms. Can you describe how gamma magnifies options positions or magnifies the value of options?
That's a good question to answer in layman's terms. I think you just answered it really well.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I would actually try to complicate it more by explaining something that could be even more simple than that. I think as we think about when we bring things down into layman's terms, we actually don't even get into the Greek conversation. We talk about more terminology of like at the money, out of the money, or where is the underlying reference price relative to where our options are set up. So we try to keep things really simplistic when we're actually talking, unless somebody wants to continue to peel back, the layers of the onion and kind of get into it. But I would actually say the way you just explained gamma was actually really well, and I probably wouldn't try to, tweak that, because I think you might just start to veer people off. Besides Investopedia.
Exactly. Just one follow-up to that. Can you describe the relationship between, gamma as we go from at the money to approach in the money? What is the relationship? There's obviously less gamma as we head towards being further in the money. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think, as we're talking about pricing risk, right, and the rate of change of move within a reference asset, as you certainly get closer, to where your price is, right, that gamma is going to change, right? You're going to get more daily moves within the overall option contract, right, and it's going to cause a much larger amount of gamma, right? And I think one thing you're wanting to manage from certainly a risk perspective, in trading options and having them in your portfolio, is how you're managing that daily move. What is the ultimate risk associated. And when you look at Gamma, you know, as we're getting closer to that reference, you know, price to what that option contract is, right, you're going to get larger moves, you know, one way or the other within the ultimate price of the contract as it pertains to the underlying reference asset.
Understood. So the last Greek on our two-bit cheat sheet, if we can go back to slide two there, Eric, I'd appreciate it, is obviously the role of Vega. And, you know, that measures the change in the options premium based on a 1% change in implied volatility. Can you elaborate on that? How you guys think through Vega and its role in options pricing?
Yeah, you mentioned implied volatility, and implied volatility is just a forecasting of what that reference asset might do within that time frame of the option contract. It's not saying whether it'll go up or down, it's just saying what the implied volatility, what the volatility will be during that time frame. So with that higher implied vol, you'll have higher premiums. And for us and some of our products, if we're selling calls to bring in income, we want that higher premium to come in.
There was one thing I've been thinking about a little bit in today's market is that, you know, when I started trading, which was millennia ago, the biggest concern was, if I'm on the long side, what is my potential risk on the downside? And now it seems like we're in a market where, you know, this melt-up scenario where there's more FOMO and missing the upside of the market, mm-hmm. as opposed to worrying about the downside. How are you guys thinking through positioning options, positioning portfolios, positioning your products to accommodate for that? I don't want to call it a new mentality in the market, but certainly the prevailing mentality of things.
Yeah, so we have a variety of different products that take different exposures to underlying asset classes and different directional bias, you know, in the market. I think when we think about a covered call, right, a scenario in a product we've talked a lot about so far on the show, has been being long an underlying asset like Apple and selling a call against it, right? It's the fear of, yeah, what if Apple goes up above 200, you know, in that scenario? How do I protect that? When we think about it in our products, we look at all the Greeks we just mentioned, and we look at creating a probability and essentially almost a forecast of where the next 30 days is going to be, a more shorter term, you know, view on the underlying reference asset. In this case, we have an S&P 500 product. So we're trying to gauge where is the S&P 500 going to be going for the next 30 days as we have some short option positions against our long equity position. We like to target an income focus, you know, in that product. And so when we're looking at targeting a specific income, at least on a monthly basis for investors, once we hit that kind of income threshold, we look to not write our options on our entire portfolio. We want to leave a portion of those equities with the ability to appreciate as much as the underlying S&P 500 does. So as we think about kind of the FOMO of missing out on the upwards, we have a number of different factors within our investment process. But in short, right, we want to deliver, because the first investment objective is income, we want to deliver our income that we should be targeting. Outside of that, we want to have our investment philosophy really look at trying to capture then as much of the upside, you know, as we can. It can't always be 100 because you're selling an option to generate income, but you want to think about it.
That's the juggling act, isn't it? Yeah. It's the probability of, am I going to be called on this stuff? You know, can you describe your SPYR product? Because, you know, you're looking for additional income on top of basically an index product.
Yep.
So can you elaborate a little bit on that as to what gives you gray hair in terms of trying to figure out the probability of, is this stuff actually as far out of the money as I need it to be? Is it going to generate the right amount of income relative to the underlying?
Yeah, so for SPYI, we're basically long a basket of S&P 500 stocks in the same weighting, so we're not trying to do anything fundamentally or change the S&P 500. We like the index, it's a great core exposure. What we're doing to bring in income is, on a monthly basis, we're selling an out-of-the-money laddered covered call strategy using SPX index options. We use the index options for tax efficiency, for liquidity, and obviously exposure to the S&P 500. So we're selling this laddered short call portfolio to bring in the income, as Garrett had mentioned. And the target for that is anywhere from 10 to 12% a year. We're trying to bring in that income to distribute on a monthly basis to clients. But what we're doing is we have a one-month roll, but our duration's a little longer. So when we're closing those short calls, there are still two weeks or so till they would have expired. We do that because within our probability analysis, we could capture the most premium within that one-month period of these out-of-the-money calls. And when we're looking at a number of factors and what deltas we're going to be selling and stuff, we've done a lot of analysis looking at how could we not only bring in this income, but how could we not cover 100% of the notional, as Garrett had mentioned. So to give you an idea, since we launched the product about a year and a half ago, we've covered anywhere from 75 to 90% of the notional. And that changes depending on where volatility is during the month and what kind of income we could bring in. And on average, those short calls are anywhere from 1% to 4% out of the money. So we're saying that as a whole package, you could participate to that, you know, 1% to 4% out of the money, but there's also that, call it 20% or so of the portfolio that's not capped, so we can capture a lot of that upside past that.
Right.
And that's the idea behind what we're trying to do in SPYI.
So what is a laddered call?
So ladder calls, we're selling multiple calls. We're not just selling one call. So we think about some of our previous products, some of the early option-based ETFs we brought out in the market, you know, a decade ago, where they were all index-based. Now things have gently moved over the number of years to more of active management. But back then, everything was passively managed, tracking an index, and it was a straight-up buy-right strategy. You're buying a reference asset, and you're selling an at-the-money call to bring in income, but you're capping yourself on 100% of the notional. You can't participate in that market. What we're doing is we're laddering the short calls out. So we're doing, you know, instead of one, we might have two short calls in that range of, you know, 1% to 4% out of the money and not capping with 100% of the notional. So we get more upside participation, more equity risk in that, but more, market risk to be able to participate on the upside.
Can you guys talk a little bit about, I got some very good friends in Southern California, and they, I think they got put in Boeing from their financial advisor. I think they got put in Boeing right before the door blew out of the 737. And my first question to them was, well, what's the process behind that? What's your thinking behind it? It's a little bit granular, but can you guys sort of just walk through how you analyze the market? You know, if you're going to make these options decisions on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you're physically doing to look at those things? And we really are getting into how the sausage is made, but can you, you know, just talk a little bit about your personal process as a professional options trader?
Sure, I'll start and then I'll let Gary go. But for us, it all starts with research. And before we bring any ETF out to the marketplace, we spend months on researching what we're looking to bring out in a product, what kind of core exposure we want. Like we're talking about our S&P 500 product. We're looking at other products to bring out in the marketplace that have different core exposures. But then we start to dive in and say, what's the goal of this product? As we were saying with SPYI, we want to bring out that 10 to 12% income. How can we do that? What kind of option portfolio will give us that kind of income, but will also let us participate in the upside? So it all starts with the research, and that's, for us, it's months of research. It's back and forth between Garrett, myself, and the rest of the team at Neos, really diving into what different option strategies would have done, what they might look like, how we can manage them on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, but also how we could sell it in the end, how we could tell an advisor, this is what we do, this is how we do it, and they can understand it and say, I'm going to bring this back to my client and see if we can invest in your product. So I think it's a process from research all the way to, does this make sense from a sales standpoint? Will the market understand it? Is it something that people will want to buy?
Yeah, and I would emphasize, I think, thinking about the end result, right? Are we providing a solution to the market, right? Are there problems or challenges in investors' portfolios that they can't get within the current market offerings? And so we think about creating a solution to solve a problem for an investor. Then we think about, okay, how do we get to that solution? And so sometimes we think about it almost like when people are thinking fundamentally, you have a bottom-up approach, you know, you have a top-down approach. And so we think about kind of in the same ways of, okay, we can get really nerdy and get into all of our quant models about from a bottom-up approach, but does that at the very end produce investment results that are going to serve the needs of whatever a client needs in their portfolio? So I think it's a really good process that we look at it from both angles of let's create the best investment performance that we ultimately can, but let's also make sure that the product in itself is delivering the investment objective that we feel or that we've talked about in the marketplace that is solving a need for a client and where it fits in their portfolio. I think one thing we like to really focus on is not only have we created a great investment strategy and a product, where does it fit in the portfolio? That has to make it in order for us to actually launch the product. We sit there and we think about, okay, if we allocated in our own portfolio, in our own PAs, 5% to this, 10%, 30%, 50, 60, is it a total replacement? How is that gonna act versus what my current market offerings are from just being long core vanilla, you know, indexes? And so what I would add to Troy is we go from the bottom up deep, you know, quantitative options research of looking about how every strike performs, every duration performs, how the package of a portfolio would perform, but then really thinking about where it fits within a client's portfolio and how that interacts with other investments that they're going to have, even if that's that 60-40 kind of core model. How can this enhance an investor's outcome from either tax efficient income, lowering volatility, you know, total return? Those are things that we kind of think about to ultimately back into part of our research, you know, and our models for each one of our products.
The takeaway from me on that is the amount of lift and work involved. And there's a sentiment in trading, particularly for those getting into the industry, is they want to pick or they want the easy route. And the message is there really isn't there? I mean, this is a daily grind, day in and day out. And you know, the nice thing about these ETF or these options overlaid ETFs is that we have guys like yourselves that can handle all the moving parts. can we talk a little bit about some of your fixed income products? Actually, before we do that, sorry to backtrack a little bit. One of the benefits of an options overlaid strategy is tax efficiency, which is a big deal. Now, I know some people that are whipping it around don't care, but for a lot of folks with, you know, portfolios that they have actual day jobs, this stuff matters. Can you talk a little bit about, and it's not the most exciting subject, is it? But it's all I mean. Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the tax laws that have made options investing tax efficient and why we should care about them?
Sure. I think to kick it off, we'll kind of rewind to what we were talking about earlier with index options. We use index options wherever we can in our portfolios in an option-based portfolio because you get that rule, IRS Rule 1256, which says 60% are taxed at long-term cap gains, 40% at short-term cap gains, no matter the holding period. So that's a benefit you get over some of the other products that might be out there, which are individual ETF options, individual stock options, or equity-linked notes, which certain competitors like to use. And we're looking for that tax efficiency from the beginning. So when we're in that research phase, we're saying, how can this be a product that gets us to our goal, but how can it be the most tax efficient product to get us to our goal? And that's definitely one of the ways to do it is with the index options, at least from our perspective. And then I don't know if you want to go into some of the other kind of tax benefits that we try to, like tax loss harvesting and stuff like that.
Yeah, so the ETF structure is a preferred vehicle for us to bring our products out to market and our strategies. That has been for over a decade with us, and the reason why is the ETF structure itself offers tax benefits. I think a lot of investors have gotten more comfortable the last 10 years understanding those tax benefits, but when you actually dig into the weeds, the manager has a lot of tax election options. So when we think about our strategies, how they perform, what they're going to deliver on a monthly, on a quarterly, and on an annual basis, we choose certain tax elections. And that those elections also allow us to harvest losses in the portfolio, right? Unfortunately, every trade is not always going to be a winning trade.
100%.
But when they don't work out, what's positive is that you can use that loss as a carry forward. Just like if you invested in a business or a restaurant, let's just say, and that didn't work out, you get to write off that loss towards your taxable income at the end of the year. We look at that as the same way, but all embedded within the fund in the portfolio. So if there's a chance that the market's up significantly and that short call is gonna lose money, okay, we'll capture that loss, we'll roll into our new option, but that loss is carry forward indefinitely in an ETF structure. So there is no expiration to that loss, which is great. So over time, we can carry losses forward, and we'll use a loss to pair against an income distribution. So what ends up happening in certain products of ours, depending on the one you're in, you can use these tax loss harvesting strategies. Maybe a lot of other people are used to them. Certainly it's what every advisor is doing in their portfolio for their clients on an annual basis. Same concept from the equity side, from the option side, where we could harvest a loss to pair against our distributable income. That gets to reclassify the distribution as a return of capital. I don't want to say return of principal. We're not looking to return people's initial investments. We want to reclassify a portion of that distribution where a return of capital is not taxed in that current tax year. It's called tax deferral. It will defer it because it lowers the overall cost basis in the fund. But you're assuming a 10 to 12% distribution yield on an annual basis, where a significant portion of that will be defined from a tax perspective as a return of capital. And that can be much more advantageous for investors, where you can reinvest either, of course, in the same fund and another investment and compound on a very high net after-tax basis. So we think about the investment products we use being index options and getting that 1256. We think about ways that our investment philosophy could tax loss harvest, and then we utilize the ETF structure as a way to carry losses forward indefinitely to pair against future taxable gains that would be distributed in the funds, to try to make sure that as we think about the total return and the monthly distributions for investors, that we're trying to deliver the best net after tax return for them.
So the one of your 1 to 3 month treasury bill product, can you talk a little bit about that put spread overlay on that? You know, how are you buying T-bills on one hand and then, selling options on another hand to realize a little more income? Can you talk a little bit about that and the moving parts involved with that?
Sure. So this is a product that Garrett and I have been talking about for years, I think.
Yeah, long time.
And we were trying to bring out a product that was very liquid, low vol, fits into that ultra short duration bucket that this product fits in. Try to bring an option strategy on top of whatever your cash was paying you and give you an extra 1 to 1.5% a year. So we're looking at it where T-bills, now we all know they're paying well over 5% on a 1 to 3 month T-bill, but when we built the product, it was basically zero.
Yeah.
So we're trying to give you a monthly distribution that would add up to about 1 to 1.5% a year. And that's where we started with the product. And when we launched the product in August of 22, T-bills were yielding 2.25, 2.30. So we said we have this really attractive product yielding, 3.5 to 4%. This is going to garner some attention. And what we're doing on the actual product is we're long 1 to 3 month T-bills. And then on a weekly basis, we're selling a deep out of the money SPX index put spread strategy. So we have about 4 different put spreads that we're in on a weekly basis. And those put spreads are anywhere from 8 to 10% out of the money. So deep out of the money, we didn't want to take any added risk or added volatility, and we're just collecting those premiums on a weekly basis. The duration of when we enter these trades is about 2 weeks, but we close them after 1 week and roll into the next one.
So for folks that this is their first foray into options, what is a put spread?
So yeah, we're selling a put below where the market is, and then we're hedging that actual short put. We don't want to take exposure on the short put too much and buying a put below it, so it's a put spread. So your risk is on the spread. If we're selling a put 5% out of the money and buying one 10% out of the money, your risk is that 5% between the two strikes.
Now, can you talk a little bit about, September of 22, if we have a 9% down month or 9% down week.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about how options perform, how you think through, I don't want to say black swan events, but can you think through, what are the moving parts involved in thinking through how to accommodate something like that?
Yeah, I'll start and Troy can jump in. So we actually think about risk two ways. The black swan, where you're down 30% in a COVID world, in a 30-day period, 45-day period. We also think about more of a risk market where you're in 2022, the completely unexpected precipitous decline down 3 to 4% month after month to have a negative 25% year where you don't get much of a relief rally. So we think about risk management from kind of more both of those perspectives. CSHI and this treasury product that we were just referring to, in a September of 22, the investment process was driven on this weekly rebalance, staying, as Troy had mentioned, 8 to 10% away from where the current market is in a weekly rebalance. Those two mechanisms help you constantly stay away as the market is selling off. So we saw the option part of that portfolio only down 6 basis points when the S&P was down, you know, over 9%. So we were able to manage risk because we're constantly rolling and changing our options. So for, in more layman's terms, we're rebalancing, right, our options portfolio every week to make sure that as the market is selling off, we're slowly moving our options farther and farther away from where the market is, so that as that, you know, gamma picks up, right, as that risk picks up, to getting closer to that that put spread, right, we want to constantly be reducing that risk. And that's what able to have that fund up roughly, you know, about 14 basis points when treasuries were earning 20, was because we only lost about 6 basis points in the options, because you're constantly thinking about rolling down and out. So same thing, COVID scenario, you know, each week we would have been rolling down and out if the product was there, and that's helping through risk mitigation. But we do think about it not only in those black swan, unknown, quick events, but really what's the longer term, you know, if we went into a bigger recession, you know, and you're having precipitous declines, how are you constantly being able to try to generate the income, you know, from the portfolio without, you know, having a significant amount of risk?
Can we change tunes just a little bit? And what is, you know, how are you guys thinking through this market on a macro basis fundamentally? Does it, you know, one of my biggest concerns, or one of the ways I'm thinking about it is, you know, my chief book is obviously in FX, and I'm always watching, particularly if, you know, if we're in a deflationary low growth environment, generally the dollar strengthens, and then I can, you know, watch for signs of that or position myself accordingly. But one of the things that concerns me in today's market particularly is this Magnificent Seven concentration, and I realize the Mag Seven thing has become a key word, but, you know, if we start to see just two or three of those crack, you know, maybe Apple starts to make a lower high and drift down, and we're talking 7-8% of the S&Ps, you know, Meta starts to do the same thing. Now we're starting to see a lot of cap-weighted relative weakness in the index. Are these things you're concerned about, given, you know, what is your base case for 2024?
Sure, I'll start. I think when we're looking at scenarios like that, you know, take our S&P 500 product, because that is very, you know, weighted to that Mag 7 group of stocks. So if you're looking at that, and yes, if we do see some of that crack, we're still tracking the index from an underlying equity standpoint. We're not changing anything we're doing there, but we might see a pickup in volatility. And with that pickup in volatility, we might be able to bring in more income from our option portfolios. So we're always watching what these underlying stocks are doing versus what volatility is doing versus what kind of income we could bring in. You know, another thing we're looking at is what's the Fed going to do? Everybody thought they were going to start cutting in March. Now everybody's waiting to see what they say next week. But in reality, they're probably not going to cut in March. But maybe at some point this year, they will start cutting. And what does that mean for our CSHI product that is long T-bills? You know, we went from August of 22 when we launched the product to getting 2.25 to now where we are now, over 5% on those T-bills. But as that starts to cut, we're still looking to bring in the same amount of income with our option portfolio. So it's just an added income on top of the T-bills, wherever those T-bills are.
Do we finish S&P below 4,000 in the end of 24? And I realize, you know, at Hedge, we don't like to make a call.
Yeah, you don't like to make a call.
You know, this has been a pretty impressive melt-up going into the beginning of the year here.
Yeah, it has. You know.
I think it's been an impressive melt-up, but look at what we've done over 2 years. How much have we melted up?
Yeah.
So I think...
Relatively, yes.
We've had a great November, December, and then we're having a nice rally now. But I think, you know, going forward, if these companies in the S&P 500, NASDAQ 100, so far keep delivering... and the Fed can manage what they're trying to do with inflation. You know, we don't have a company view on it, but I think we can move higher in the markets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really Fed-driven at the end of the day. I think earnings, right, are supporting a lot of the move in the S&P now. Like, we're starting to see report, you know, earnings reports come through. They're actually supporting kind of where the S&P is at this point. Back to the Magnificent Seven, a lot of those stocks have really almost become more utilities as they used to be tech growth and very more speculative. I mean, talk about, you know, the amount of cash on Apple's balance sheet, right, and just the fact that almost, you know, what, two out of three, if not more, three out of four people have an Apple iPhone or a Mac or some type of computer. I mean, they're insulated kind of utilitarian type businesses now. And so that index has shifted a little bit. Yes, you've still seen massive growth just because I think the adoption of tech, but, you know, so that's part of the companies. I think it's going to be Fed driven at the end of the day because it just depends. Are we going to hang at this, you know, 10-year treasury rate of, you know, 410, 420? Are we going to see inflation pick up and then not really get the inflation tamed with strong job growth because these companies are still reporting and still driving earnings and being able to have a robust job market? I think the Fed ultimately is, and inflation is what's going to end up driving, you know, whatever the price action of, you know, the S&P and the equity markets, you know, are going to do. We have seen bond volatility come in pretty significantly, right? So when you think about the MOVE index, you know, beginning part of last year, it was at 180, right? We're now hovering between the 100, 120, you know, more normalized, you know, kind 100%. Of compression of that. So I think as we think about, like, our focus and our forecast of next year, it's maybe not so much a price target, but it's like, what are we really looking at? We're we're focused on the Fed, you know, we're focused on where interest rates are, you know, and there are underlying concerns, right? If interest rates do stay high for a long period of time, how long can the consumer weather all of that adjustable rate debt they have? Credit cards, you know, second homes for the people that are fortunate enough for a second home that's going to adjust much higher. You know, college loans, you know, those types of things. How is that going to ultimately affect if inflation isn't tamed and we can't slowly at least start reducing interest rates? I think we believe that there is a higher for longer relative to where we've been, right? So as we think about where interest rates have been, they've been at zero and depressed for, you know, better part of a decade. There has to be a higher for longer relative to that. But where we are right now, hopefully, you know, we can be able to navigate this, you know, kind of soft landing and manage some reduction of interest rates this year.
So one of the things that we spend a ton of time on at Tier 1, obviously, you know, Craig models out a lot of target date funds. And, you know, our big macro thesis with that, obviously, is, well, as long as people are employed, they allocating to a 401, which means that the boys at Vanguard are buying a couple times a month. And, you know, until that dynamic changes, and obviously we get super granular in terms of claims and job openings, and are job openings advertised as, you know, sort of ghost jobs to represent growth? And I mean, there's a million rabbit holes with that, but as long as people are employed, they're going to continue to allocate to these things, which is supportive in the market. So
agreed. And taking a step further, I think almost back to when we talked about the growth of the options market, I think you've also just seen a huge growth of the individual investor and the financial kind of more professional investor, but from an individual standpoint.
100%.
The ones that are actually managing their own accounts through a Schwab or E-Trade or Robinhood, you know, and that's brought a whole new, I think, opportunity to be able to support the market, support where growth is coming, because they're actually investing in the market, right? People have taken a much more direct approach to looking at managing their money. It's not all just consolidated into the biggest institutions, you know, with just their 401ks coming in. They're now taking that discretionary spending that they might have not allocated their 401k or maybe even maxed out to be able to put into a brokerage account and be able to buy and trade the markets themselves. So why we've seen, you know, volumes, you know, grow, but we're seeing, you know, I think more supportive ways. Like the Dodd-Frank was a big thing, right? Everyone was concerned that when Dodd-Frank came in, a lot of the big banks weren't there to support the market anymore, right? Because they weren't allowed to trade prop, you know, but I think there's just been a total change and shift in the market structure where now you have individuals, you know, that are actually in there making their own investment bets, researching their own, following HedgEye, following Tier 1 Alpha about what you guys are suggesting to do in their portfolio. That has been very healthy for the market, you know, overall, both supporting it, but also probably the direction of where we're going and giving somewhat of a more of a normalization, you know, to, you know, the random walk of what the markets can do.
Yeah, I think that comes, it all comes back to the education and the access people have to that, whether it's internet, different, you know, YouTube channels, Twitter, anything like that. I think it comes down to the education. I look at even my children have access in school to learn about the stock market. When I was in school many years ago, they did not have a class to teach you about stocks or anything as basic as that. And I think it's just like general knowledge. You know, years and years ago, people had their pension, and that's what they had. But as you're saying, more and more people, as they're employed, they're putting money in 401k, Garrett mentioned, and then they have this discretionary money where they might not spend it, they'll invest it because they want it to grow. They want to see that growth. So I think it comes back to that education and more people understanding what they could do in the market.
So at Hedge I Love last year, there were a lot of particularly young men and women that were coming up to us and asking, what is the best way for them? What is the best way for them to think about a career in options? Is should people look at a career in options? You know, what career advice would you guys have for somebody that's new and Neos is hiring? What are they looking for in people?
I would say, first off, if you have young people in college or just getting out of college, try to educate yourself through online sources, but then also try to get an internship. Try to sit on a trading desk somewhere. And I know that seems harder than it is, but use your network. You know, when I got out of college, there was no LinkedIn. There was no real networking process other than calling people and meeting people in person. But I think now that you have this LinkedIn era and people can just kind of branch out, I think it's meeting as many people as you can, networking, and then eventually sitting with somebody a month over a summer will, you know, help you grow in your career.
Yeah. Yeah, I would add there's a lot of different ways, right, to be in the options field, right? You could be in a sales capacity, right, and talking about the product and be client-focused, you know, or you could be certainly in the research and the investment side. The research and the investment side, I would always give the advice of, right, math is your friend, right, especially with us. We're quantitatively based, but if you nowadays can really focus on understanding math, programming, coding, right, being able to, you know, to write models and stuff, I think that's going to help give you a wide option, pun intended, I guess, on that, of choices to talk to different firms. But there's, you don't have to be, right? You don't have to be super excited about just the research and investment side. You could be looking at sales or other ways to get involved in the options market and firms, you know, and help support more client-facing and discussions.
Troy, Garrett, I've enjoyed it, and I look forward to doing it again, and we'll do it deeper dive into what makes all this tick in the future. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Don't forget to check out hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.